One's too small to hold phones, so I ignore it. The other is unlocked. It's a long, narrow container that's open and empty. I strike gold with the third. It's a phone charging cabinet. I've seen simple versions in libraries and airport lounges. A box a couple of feet square with pull-out shelves for the devices. I open one drawer and see nothing. It's empty. I open the next. Same thing. I keep opening. The charge box is completely empty. Maybe this is one of those devices that seems super cool until you actually use it and realize a simple shelf with plugs would have worked better. I leave the box and look for anything big enough to hold 24 cell phones. There's nothing, really. The office isn't that big. I open drawers and glance into the shallow closet, but it's mostly office supplies and a nest of tangled device cords. The only boxes are for printer paper. They're big enough, but no one's going to dump 20 cell phones into a cardboard box. There's no better way to ensure mutiny than to hand teenagers back their devices with scratches and dings. Sure, they already have scratches and dings, but we know every last one of them, and we'd better not find new ones. There's a metal container under the printer paper cartons. I'm moving aside the first cardboard box when the contents shift in a way that paper doesn't. I open it to see the phones. 24 cell phones, tossed into a cardboard box as if headed for recycling. That must be what these are. Recycled phones. Maybe for a game or some kind of cool tech project. As I pull them into the light, though, I see a phone case that looks like Doctor Who's blue phone box. Anime characters decorate another. Not recycled phones. I dig until I find a bubblegum pink leather cover with a Mexican sugar skull sticker. I open it to see my phone. I stare down at the box. What the hell? There must be 15 grand worth of tech here, dumped into a cardboard box. I stifle a surge of indignation and turn on my phone. Nothing happens, because it's been unplugged for the past day, and I'd handed it over with 10% battery, assured by Trisha that they'd charge them for us. I dig through the box until I find a plain black leather cover, Logan's phone. As usual, my brother had the foresight to charge his and Nick's car, and it's at 85%. The facial recognition fails, of course, but I know his code. We've always known each other's codes. I enter it and wade through the inevitable barrage of text notifications. There's a goodnight one for Mom, who's thrilled that we're having such an excellent time we didn't call. You have no idea, Mom. As I look at the texts and messages, I notice the last one came in early yesterday evening. Odd, considering how many notifications he was getting until then. I see one from my ex and flip past, my stomach clenching even without reading it. The last message, a group text from a schoolmate, came in at 8 last night. A little earlier, there's one from Paige. Hey, Logan, you've probably already had your phone confiscated. Sorry about that. I'll talk to the counselors when I get there. I understand the basic principle, but you guys need to be in touch with your parents. For now, have fun, and I'll see you tomorrow. I hit reply on her message and type. It's Kate. I know Benny is sick. Tell him I said hi, and you're delayed, but seriously weird stuff is happening here. My phone's dead. I'm going to recharge it, and then Logan and I might head into the forest to wait for you. Yeah, stuff is that weird. Please don't tell Mom. Just text when you can, and I'll explain once we're out of here. I hit send. Then I return to the closet unit, where I saw a shoebox filled with cords. As I dig through the box, I listen for a reply from Paige. Sure, she's caring for her sick six-year-old, but Paige is always plugged in. She'll see my text pop up on her watch, and even if she's in the middle of giving Benny medicine, she'll let me know she'll reply ASAP. I find the right chord and then check my text to see the exclamation mark, signifying that it wasn't sent. My gaze rises to the cell service bars. We must have service, otherwise we wouldn't be given phone time every night. Yet there isn't a single bar. When I hit a couple of buttons, a message pops up. SIM card not installed. I hurry back to the box and pull out a couple of older phones without thumb or facial recognition. After a few tries, I find one that isn't passcode protected. On the opening screen, it says the same thing. No SIM card. They removed the SIM cards, took them out, and chucked all the phones into a box. That's why there's no message from Mom. They pulled the cards yesterday evening. I stuff my phone, Logan's phone, and the charge cord into my pockets. Then I start searching for our SIM cards. I'd spotted a small locked box across the room. It had been too small for all the cell phones, so I hadn't bothered snapping the lock. I do now and open it to find prescription bottles. I check a few. Adderall, Tylenol with codeine, Ambien. In other words, the counselors confiscated any medication that other campers might steal for recreational use. I dig through the box, in case the SIM cards are at the bottom. They aren't. I see a couple of other small boxes down by the floor. I bend, and as I'm picking up one, air wafts through a vent in the wall. With it comes a very distinctive smell. Blood.
Chapter 27. Logan. The fact that they locked us in the office is troubling, but it isn't as if I'm trapped here. I'm a werewolf. I snap it easily. I'll probably regret that, but I really need to find Kate. I'm heading outside when I spot Holly making her way toward her room. I call a, "Hey." But like me, Holly is one of those people who hear a hail and presume it's for someone else. By the time I call her name, she's at her room. She sees me, and I motion her inside, where we can speak in private. "Do you know where Kate is?" I ask.
"She went looking for you."
I bite back a growl of frustration. Before I can comment, Holly says,
"Paige isn't coming until tomorrow,"
and explains what Kate heard. "Do you know where Alan is?" I ask.
"Sure, outside with some other sorcerers."
I pause. "Who's all outside? Mostly spellcasters?" She frowns as she thinks,
"Actually, yes. Spellcasters and a few minor races."
"Any necromancers?"
"One, I think. I heard most are still sleeping. Partied hard enough to raise the dead, I guess. Let's just hope they didn't really raise any."
I manage a small smile at the quip, but I'm considering what she's said. The spellcasters and minor races are hanging out, killing time. The necromancers are all exhausted, like the counselor. "Can you do me a favor?" I ask. "Find Alan and stick together. Maybe stay in your room." I raise my hands against her protest. "I know that sounds like an odd request, but whatever's going on here, I believe it mostly affects the half-demons. I'm still working it out. We can talk once I find Kate." Before I can go, she taps my arm.
"About Kate, she might be distracted and just go easy on her. Elijah broke it off. Yes, I know it wasn't a real relationship, but he was weird about it. Made her feel like he was actually dumping her. She really didn't need that, especially after what happened with her last boyfriend."
I pause. "Brandon? No, he was definitely on the receiving end of that breakup. Believe me. I've been dealing with him ever since, blowing up my phone, trying to get back with her." She stares at me. "What?" I say.
"You're still talking to him?"
"Why not? It didn't have anything to do with me." He's taking it really hard. Kate can be... tempestuous. I smile. I'd say she gets it from our dad, but it comes from both parents, really. Holly's staring as if I've just sprouted hair and fangs, and I almost reach up to be sure I haven't.
Tempest...
She bites the word off.
Are you actually siding with the asshole who screwed around on your sister?
What? I'm sure I've misheard, or she's misunderstood something Kate said. By screwed around, are you implying he had sex with another girl?
No, I'm implying they built a bookshelf together. Yes, he had sex with another girl because Kate wasn't ready. Then he told her what he did, thinking that'd make her see the error of her ways, and when she didn't give him another chance, he told everyone about it. And now she's dealing with crap from him and from your local cast of mean girls.
Now I'm the one staring. Who told you this?
Who do you think told me? You can't tell me you haven't noticed. You guys go to the same school. She's your sister, Logan. Your twin sister. Did you even ask why they broke up? Maybe find out before you decide to play Cupid, getting them back together?
I didn't. She lifts her hands.
Never mind. This isn't the time. Now you know. So when you see Kate, try showing a little compassion. I know you didn't like her with Elijah, but he still hurt her, and she did absolutely nothing to deserve it.
She shakes her head.
Go, Logan. Your sister needs you.
I'm trying very hard not to think of what Holly just told me. She's right. We have more pressing concerns right now. But I keep thinking of Brandon texting me and pestering me at school, and me brushing him off politely, giving no sign that I had an issue with him. Perhaps even showing enough consideration to suggest that I sympathized with his plight. His plight. His failure to harangue my sister into having sex with him. Harangue? I almost laugh at the word. He did more than pester and plead, which would be bad enough. He screwed around with someone else and then told Kate.
See, other girls will have sex with me. Better get on this now, 'cause I am in demand.
I clench my fists and struggle against the urge to put one through the wall. A little voice whines that Kate should have told me, and now I feel sick for hanging out with him. But that's not my fault because I didn't know what happened. Bullshit. I knew Kate was upset. I saw her sinking into what we called her blue moods. Not depression, but depressive states. Retreating to her room when Mom and Dad weren't around, because they'd notice. I'd been there, though. I noticed. It was my responsibility to go to her and say, "What's wrong?" I knew she was upset over the breakup, but deep inside, I rolled my eyes and called her dramatic. Just Kate being Kate. I can say I didn't know about Brandon, but Nick hinted at it yesterday. I remember his shock on hearing I was in contact with Brandon. I might not have had a chance to pursue it with him, but I could have pursued it with her. Hey, Kate, Nick seems to know something about Brandon I don't. Can we talk about that? Nope. Instead, I was busy worrying about my roommate stomping off, a total stranger who didn't even want my help. It made me feel good to be concerned for him. Virtue signaling. See what a nice guy I am. How considerate. Not the sort of brother who rolls his eyes at his sister's pain and dismisses it as teenage girl drama. I bend at my bedroom door. Kate's trail is there. I focus on that. It leads me upstairs and down the hall toward the office. I remember those light footsteps, that careful rap on a door. Not someone timidly approaching the counselors. Kate, staging a break-in. Unable to find me, she'd taken matters into her own hands, off on an adventure by herself, giving up on me. While this is a small thing, it symbolizes so much more. Logan isn't there for me. He's been hanging out with my ex, not even asking why I broke it off. He's been hanging out with the girls who are bullying me. She'd hate that word, bullying, but that's what it was. And I can say I didn't know, but I remember catching the odd, snarky remark and dismissing it as jealousy. When she refused to join the popular clique at school, they took offense and twisted that into contempt. From, "Who does she think she is?" to, "Don't you think she's kinda weird?" I thought it had been a few backbiting comments, just typical stuff that Kate would ignore as she always did. How much worse had it gotten? Hint, she shut down her social media accounts. Faint movement sounds inside the office. Footfalls hurrying to the door. I turn the knob and push, and Kate lets out a soft gasp, her mouth opening with,
"I was looking for Trish."
Then she sees it's me and grins. And it's the grin I know so well. The grin I don't get nearly as much these days. I slide into the office and let the door close. Then I catch her up in a hug so sudden and fierce that she yelps before covering her reaction with a chuckle.
"Nice to see you too, Lo."
"Elijah is an asshole," I say as I back up. There's a flicker of consternation that I know. Or maybe because I know and thought she would need that hug. She makes a face. Such a Kate face. It's a mom face, too, throwing off concern, not wanting to be seen as the type of person who needs it. She shrugs.
"I'm not sure about asshole, but he's something, that's for sure.
He's..." I start to tell her that he's Logan Johnson's half-brother. But this isn't the time. It's also not the time to say I know about Brandon, and I'm going to kick his ass. Well, not literally kick his ass. I'd like to, both his and Elijah's. But Kate wouldn't want that. And I'm not sure once I started kicking that I'd stop. I'll tear a verbal strip off them instead. Not as satisfying, but safer. "Forget about Elijah," I say.
"I have," she says. "For now, at least. I was just coming to find you."
"I know. I heard about Paige."
"And it seems that's the least of our worries."
Kate holds up my cell phone and shows a text she sent Paige, undelivered. My gaze shoots to the signal strength indicators. There aren't any. "They're blocking the signal," I say. I'm not surprised. That's draconian, but if they really want us offline this week, they need to do that. Someone's bound to have smuggled in a cell-ready device.
"It's not a blocker," she says. "They've removed the SIM card."
She walks over and picks up a printer paper carton. Inside is a jumble of cell phones.
"They removed all the SIM cards and dumped the phones in here."
Okay, this is different. This is worse. "We need to find those SIM cards," I say.
"Agreed. And I was doing that before..."
She tugs me to the far wall and motions for me to crouch and inhale. It takes a moment. Then I detect the unmistakable odor of blood. Kate's already heading for the door. I follow. She checks the hall. It's still silent, so we creep to the next door. Kate tries the handle. Then she snaps it and pushes open the door. Inside is a dorm room like ours, except this one is brightly lit from that windowed ceiling. Despite the light, though, someone is still in bed, and Kate draws back, as if to retreat. Then she inhales and audibly swallows. I know why. I tap her hip, saying I'll go first, but of course she ignores me. She slips forward. I step into the room and shut the door behind me. Kate continues to the bed. Despite the stifling heat, the covers are pulled up to the sleeper's face. Kate stops, her nose wrinkling as she rubs it, banishing a smell. She stands there, looking down, and I know she's fighting the urge to check for vital signs. There's no need. She realizes that from the smell, not the blood, that only signifies injury. It's the other smell, the one from a corpse left in a sweltering hot room. Kate draws back the comforter. It's a female counselor, one I remember seeing at the counselor's dining table yesterday. She'd sat near the end, focused on her meal, quiet as I spoke to the others. I'd presumed it was my presence making her uncomfortable. Perhaps not. As Kate pulls off the comforter, the smell of decomp rises, freed from the sheets. Kate exhales, as if expunging it from her nose. The bloodied top sheet sticks to the young woman's body. Kate peels it back as I pad forward to see no signs of injury. There's blood on the counselor's t-shirt, but when Kate discreetly tugs that up, the young woman's torso is nearly clean. I'm reminded of Mason's fast-healing wound, but the real answer is the blood drying from under her nose. That's the only sign of injury. Like Mason yesterday when he'd been attacked in the forest, dead, his only injury a bleeding nose. Just like Mason. Except no one was here to revive her.
Chapter 28. Kate. The counselor is dead. I don't even know her name. Don't remember speaking to her. And now she's dead. As Logan watches, I check her torso and arms more carefully, and then lift her hands, turning them this way and that. I'm looking for defensive wounds and seeing none. Then I finger the woman's wrist, and I see bruises there. More bruises on one shoulder and her opposite side. Scratches on her arm. Signs she'd either been restrained and beaten, or beaten and then restrained. I think of what Logan said had happened to Mason. His bloodied nose, his heart stopping. Did something similar happen here? Had an otherworldly whatever killed the counselor? Then her roomie, not being a werewolf, hadn't noticed the smell and just let her sleep? That's what I want to believe. An outside force killed this counselor, not anyone here. Logan moves forward and checks the young woman's shirt. Through the blood, I read Team Witch. Logan murmurs, "One witch, one necro, five half-demons." Hmm? He opens his mouth, but before he can get out a word, footfalls thunder down the hall. I freeze, but they're at the far end where the meeting had been. They only sound loud because there are so many of them. The meeting is out. Campers charging from the room as if they're thundering from last class. Logan moves to the door to listen. I look for a hiding place. When steps come our way, I yank the sheets over the dead girl again, and we both duck and roll under the beds. The steps continue past the door. More follow, and the doorknob turns. I hold my breath. Across the way, Logan's gaze follows the sound. He's tensed and ready for trouble. But the door only opens a moment as someone reaches in and grabs an item from the dresser top. Then it shuts again, and the footsteps retreat. When I start to slide out, Logan motions for me to wait. Seconds tick past. Then the other footsteps pass, as if they'd only gone to a room temporarily. Now they head over to the other hall. I catch the click of a door. "About time," a voice growls. It's Mason. "The pup went to lift his leg on a tree somewhere." "He's outside?" Trisha says. Mason snorts. "Maybe. You can't tell with werewolves. I think he planned to just use the regular facilities, though." "Jose," Trisha says. "Go get Logan. Has anyone found his sister?" "Still looking," Jose says. "She's around. She's been hanging out with that witch and that guy with dreads." A pause. "I didn't see him with the other HDs. HDs? Half demons, right. That's what Elijah is posing as. Just find the Kurs. The sooner we're rid of these parasites, the better. Parasites? That's a common insult for vampires. But Trisha obviously is including werewolves in that. Across the way, Logan tenses. My gaze shoots to him. Through the wall, I hear Mason say, "What the fuck?" "Someone's coming to take you and your canine buddies out of here. Unless you'd rather walk?"
"I might. Could use the exercise. But if you want me gone, just say the word and let me grab my shit."
"It's packed and outside. Now come on." I relax. Okay. The situation isn't as dire as it seemed. I have no idea what happened to the poor girl rotting in the bed above me, but I'm going to guess no one here is to blame. Whatever happened to Mason also happened to her. And this morning, her roommate presumed she was sleeping off a late night. That means others are in danger from whatever's going on. But Paige can resolve that tomorrow. Right now, we're being kicked out. And considering I didn't plan to stick around, that's fine with me.
"You heard all that?"
Logan says as we slide from under the beds.
"I did.
It's the excuse we need to leave and get someplace where we can notify Paige. I'd like to see whether Holly and Alan will join us. We should probably warn Elijah, too, in case they realize he's a werewolf."
"He isn't coming with us,"
Logan says, face darkening. "Nope, he's not. But he deserves a warning. Now let's get out of here." On the way to the stairs, Logan whispers his theory. Whatever's happening here, it's affecting the half-demons. Well, the hormonal part, that is. Something else is up with the necromancers, and it's probably connected to those ghostly encounters we had in the forest. I suspect they're being pestered or harassed by ghosts. And they're too exhausted and distracted to notice what's going on with the half-demons.
"Could it be possession?" I whisper. "Half-demons are more susceptible to it. I've never heard of mass possession, but that could be the answer."
"Except they don't seem possessed. They aren't acting like themselves, but they aren't not acting like themselves, if that makes any sense."
"It does.
Trisha is no longer the bubbly young woman we met when we arrived, but it's been a gradual change, not the sudden one of possession."
"What about the guy who tried to cut your Achilles tendon?" I say. "He's a sorcerer."
"Mob mentality? He's not actually affected, but seeing the rest act out gives him an excuse to do the same. There are others like him, I suspect, who've joined in."
"And there are some who won't join in, even if the half-demons try to convince them. Some who will rebel in horror." I think of the dead counselor's Team Witch shirt. Had she realized something was wrong, and they murdered her for it? I don't want to think that. I can't, literally cannot. It goes too far. Cutting Logan's tendon is crazy, but it's the sort of thing that does happen when a mob gets out of control. Murder goes beyond that. And if that counselor was killed because she was interfering with plans, I don't even want to know what those plans are. I need to believe that whatever's happening here, it's manageable insanity, which we will manage by gathering Holly and Alan and any other spellcasters who want to come with us. And then we'll get Paige and her resources to truly squelch this fire before it spreads. We can hear voices outside. Once I catch a snarl from Mason. Seriously, the guy missed his supernatural calling. He snarls and growls and grunts more than any werewolf. Whatever he's bitching about now, it's only a snarled word that I don't catch, and then he falls silent. Probably some token protest against being kicked out. He doesn't want to stay, but he won't like leaving at the end of a boot either. Can't say I blame him.
If I didn't suspect we were dealing with something more than paranoid teens, I'd argue the point too. But whatever has gone wrong, it's otherworldly, demonic, ghostly, something else altogether. This is not the sort of thing you can treat rationally. It's time to get the hell out and look forward to having a lifelong excuse to never attend a supernatural leadership conference again. We sneak down the stairs, moving quietly despite the empty and silent floor below. When we reach the bottom, someone clears a throat and I spin. It's one of the counselors, flanked by two campers, all three in team half-demon tees. "Hey," I say, "I heard you guys were looking for us."
"Outside,"
the counselor says with a jerk of his chin. "Did I hear you want us gone?" I continue. I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but I point at my ear. Werewolf hearing, can't help it. You can imagine how much fun that was for our parents. We heard all the grown-up conversations, and we didn't need to put a glass to the door.
"Outside," the counselor says again.
"Sure," I say. "We don't want to be anywhere we aren't wanted. But I left my notebook under my bed. Just let me grab that and..." One of the campers steps forward. He'd been partially hidden by the counselor, and as he moves, I see something in his hand. It rises, and I fall back against Logan with, "Holy shit!" It's a gun. A hunting rifle. I remember the long, empty lockbox upstairs in the office. This is what had been inside it.
"A gun?"
Logan says, bristling with mere annoyance, as if the guy pulled a water pistol.
"I can assure you, this is not necessary." Kate asked politely to retrieve her notebook. "If that isn't possible, then just say so. Now lower the gun."
"No."
Logan's voice hardens.
"We are the Alpha's children. You are threatening us with a rifle when we are complying with your orders. Unless you want to invoke the wrath of the werewolf pack, please show a little respect and lower..."
The guy raises it to my chest.
"No."
Logan rocks forward. The guy's finger moves to the trigger.
"Low,"
I whisper, and he stops.
"It's okay,"
I murmur under my breath, heart pounding.
"We're fine."
Louder, I say, "Take us outside and we'll go." The trio leads us down the hall. At a noise down a side passage, I glance as discreetly as I can. It's Elijah. He's half out of his room, poised there, as if spotting me, ready to retreat. Then he sees the rifle. His eyes widen. Hand at my side, I gesture for him to go back into his room. Do I hope he'll stand firm and refuse? Stride down here and demand to know what's going on? Better yet, sneak down and wrest the gun away from this guy? Yes, I do. But I also know that isn't the smart move. Elijah makes the smart move. He eases back into his room and closes the door quietly, and I try not to be disappointed.
"I heard you say someone's coming for us," Logan says as we reach the door. "That isn't necessary. We'll walk out. We know the way."
They don't even acknowledge he's spoken. One pushes on the door, and the noise from outside rushes in. Hoots and hollers and jeers. Clearly, the half-demons are looking forward to seeing us banished. Fine by me. We'll give them their show. It'll sting, but we'll do it. We'll walk away, knowing this will be resolved later, and every adult half-demon in any position of power will be tripping over themselves to assure the werewolves and vampires no insult was intended. It was all a mistake. That'll give Mom plenty of political ammunition. We'll get concessions from this fiasco, and that'll help our standing in the supernatural world.
I keep telling myself this as they push us through the door at rifle point. I pay little attention to our surroundings, caught up in my own thoughts of the future. Keep my mind on that, and I can endure this humiliation. In the end, we will win. There's a crowd ahead. At least a dozen campers ringed around a campfire. It's not lit, thankfully, because one of the idiots is standing in the middle of it.
Mason?
Logan whispers. I frown over to see Logan staring at the fire pit. I follow his gaze back to it and realize the idiot standing in the middle of the piled wood is Mason. No, he's not standing in the middle. He's bound to a pole in the middle, with wood and kindling stacked at his feet and a gag over his mouth. He snarls and writhes as the half-demons jeer and catcall and wave lighters and matches over their heads. And beside him, two other fire pits, two other poles, two funeral pyres, waiting for us.
Chapter 29. Logan. I am a werewolf. You may not need a silver bullet to take me down, but the threat of a mere hunting rifle is not enough for me to step into a fire pit to be burned at the stake. I cannot be taken that easily. I'm a trained fighter with superhuman strength. That is the thought screaming through my mind as I go down under the barrage of blows and kicks. This is not going to happen. The moment Kate and I saw what lay ahead, we swung on our captors, and a half dozen campers jumped from their ambush spot by the door. The others around the fire join them, and we are swarmed by 20 supernaturals. We fight as if we're the ones demon-possessed, but ultimately, we fall under those blows, under the very crush of our attackers' bodies. Even when they have us down, we still fight. But it does no good. We're bound and dragged to the fire pit, and all of our struggles only earn us more blows, only sap our strength, until we're hauled onto a pyre. They don't bother with the third stake. They put us both on one, back to back. And the last view I have of my sister's face is blood and dirt and impossibly wide eyes. Eyes wide not with terror, but with shock. Those eyes scream three words. I don't understand. I know my sister, and I know what she's been telling herself, that no one here killed the witch counselor. She was not silenced. She was murdered by a ghost or demon or other supernatural force. That makes sense to Kate. This does not.
Why?
She croaks as they tighten the nylon ropes around our wrists and ankles.
Why?
She isn't asking why this is happening to us. She's asking why it's happening at all. How it can be happening. How 20 fellow supernaturals could want to kill us in the most terrible and symbolic way possible. Burned at the stake. It's the fate of so many of our kind, all of our kinds. Sorcerer, witch, necromancer, werewolf, vampire, half-demon, we have all been burned at the stake for the heresy of our powers. Such a death rings with symbolism to every person here. It is what humans have done to us. It is not ever what we do to one another. Kate asks why, and they don't answer. They sneer and they mock her, but they don't answer. If forced to respond, they might say they fear us. They might say we are a danger or an abomination. None of that is the reason, though. It's just the excuse. It's what they tell themselves. While the truth blazes from their eyes, rings from their laughter. They're doing this because they want to. Whatever fills them, that adrenaline and rage, this is how they'll exercise it. Exercise it, not exorcise it. Because they don't want to be rid of it. This rage is exciting. It makes their hearts beat faster, their adrenaline pump. it makes them feel powerful. And all that, while a lovely little revelation, does not resolve the fact that we're bound to stakes in a laid fire pit. Reflecting on it, however, is only a way to keep me calm while I do something about it. When we were first bound, we tried the ropes, of course, but they aren't anything we can snap. They've been careful about that. Now Kate's working at the knots while exhorting the non-demons in the crowd to do something.
"You're surrounded by half-demons," she's saying to someone. "Doesn't that tell you something?"
A chorus of catcalls drowns out any response.
"Whatever this is," she says, voice rising, "it's affecting demon blood. They have an excuse. You don't. You're about to commit murder."
"No,"
a girl yells. "We're about to exterminate parasites. Kill you before you kill us."
Kate keeps arguing, trying to reason with those in the crowd who should be open to reason, those uninfected by whatever has ignited the blood of the half-demons. Normally, that would be what I'd do. Right now, though, I'm working on a backup plan. My mom has a trick she taught herself, one my dad can do but less expertly, lacking the patience to learn it. Mom can localize her change, specifically her hand, allowing it to shift to a stage between human and wolf. It seems like a parlor trick, yet it comes with one very useful advantage. Her fingers become claws. With it, she can pin a werewolf to a wall with nails sharp enough to rip out their throat. The fact she's still human means she can threaten or negotiate. I've been practicing this mostly to improve overall control of my shifts. Now, as Kate engages the crowd, I focus on shifting my hand, feeling hair sprout on the back of it. I keep my fingers cupped away from the crowd so they won't see what I'm doing. Sweat beads, and I blow upward, trying to unstick hair tickling my forehead. "You think it's warm now? Just wait until they light that fire." Slowly, my fingers begin to change, thicker, stubbier, the nails thickening too. I pluck at the nylon. My nails aren't sharp enough to cut through the rope, but I can slice threads. It's slow going. Kate's still shouting at the non-demons in the group, trying to make them see reason, but they're caught up in the fervor, mocking her nonsense. To them, there's nothing wrong with the half-demons. They've just had enough of parasites like us. They're feeding on the frenzy of the others. It validates their own rage. "See, I'm not wrong to feel this way. Others do too." What will they do when they realize they're wrong? That the half-demons have an excuse, and they do not? That's the true horror here. Not the infected half-demons, but the handful of others who have joined in, ready to light us on fire because it's the rare opportunity to indulge their worst instincts. I've been worrying about what I'm becoming, how much I am like my father, how my own instincts are rising up and shutting down common sense. What am I capable of? Not this. Never this. Whatever lurks inside me, it's dark and it's frightening, but it's not this. My darkness is cold steel, dangerous and deadly, and I need to learn to control it. But it's a weapon, not a fire that consumes, a fire willing to set anything ablaze on the flimsiest of pretenses. My darkness is my father's, and my mother's too. It's the werewolf instinct to protect and defend at any cost. Yet they could never get caught up in what's happening here. They don't have a fire that needs feeding, a rage that demands an outlet. They'd be the ones trying to stop it. Well, they'd stop it to save Kate and me. Mom would fight for Mason if it wasn't obvious suicide, and Dad would help because she'd want it, not because he gives a damn about a stranger. Just as I think that, Holly peeks around the far end of the building. She pulls back quickly, and then Alan looks. I shake my head, trying to motion them back with my chin. They withdraw. Like I said, Mom would fight for strangers if it wasn't suicidal. This is suicidal. Better Holly and Alan stay back and stay safe. They peek out every few seconds. I keep shaking my head, warning them not to do anything stupid. And I keep snapping these threads. When I've weakened my bindings, I do the same for Kate. She tenses as the rough pad of my finger brushes her. Then she feels the hard nail working at her rope.
Mom's trick? She says.
Yep.
Damn. When'd you learn that?
The words sound like Kate, taking this whole burning at the stake problem in stride. But her voice wavers, telling me she's struggling to stay calm. When I've weakened her rope, I tap her arm with three fingers. Then I tap two, starting the countdown. Her fingers close around mine.
No,
she says.
Not yet.
Why? You've got more to say?
One of the half-demons yells.
We're getting a little tired of your voice, Blondie. Time to break out the marshmallows.
Hoots and hollers sound, and Holly peeks again. She motions something I don't catch, and then she withdraws. Kate's not yet wasn't for the crowd. It was for me. After a burst of pique, what the hell are we waiting for? I answer my own question. If we break free now, we're right back where we were when we got jumped coming out of that door, facing this entire mob. I should have thought of that. Kate should have been the one leaping in without thinking it through. And does that matter? I keep putting things in terms of which of us should do them. This is a Kate move. That's a Logan one. As if our roles are clearly delineated. As if I lose something by failing to do the Logan thing, and she steals from me by doing it herself. We are not children. We're leaving those old roles behind. I have no idea what we'll become, but it does no good to keep fighting the changes. My sister is correct. We need a distraction. And I'd love to be able to ask Holly and Alan to provide it, but there's no way of doing that. We can only rely on each other.
Start with the vamp,
someone shouts. I can't see Mason's pyre. It's behind me, and he's facing the opposite way. The wood creaks as he struggles, and I'm sure every one of his grunts is a muffled expletive. He's terrified, too. The stink of sweat and fear wafts from him, overpowering Kate's lighter musk of anxious sweat. If Mason dies, he'll come back to life. That doesn't matter. I saw his terror when he thought he'd risen as a vampire. That is a fate to postpone for as long as he can. Then I remember the cut on his side, the one that healed instantly. And I remember a story in one of the council books I'd been too young to read. The eyewitness account of the burning of a vampire. You cannot kill a vampire by burning, nor by a stake to the heart. That makes no more sense than needing silver bullets for a werewolf. The only way to kill a vamp is to inflict the one injury that cannot heal, decapitation. In that account, the mob did not decapitate their victim before lighting the pyre, and I had nightmares for weeks afterward of imagining her torment, able to burn but unable to die, her flesh constantly healing. When I confessed to Mom what I'd read, I'd half expected to be banned from that library for life. Instead, I no longer had free access to it, needing to run my selections past Mom or Dad. I think of that story, and I smell Mason's terror. And I know he's realized the same thing. He will heal, burn, and heal. I swallow hard, and I open my mouth to say something to the mob, to convince them to start with us. But if they start with him, is that not the distraction we need? He'll heal. How cold does that feel, to let him suffer so we can get free? Yet it's the logical choice. He will suffer, but he will heal. and he will have the chance to free all three of us.
Burn the vamp!
Someone yells, and others take up the chant, and I clamp my mouth shut.
Sure, Kate yells. Burn the vamp, so he can come back and slaughter every last one of you. You do understand that's how it works, right? He's still human. He hasn't died yet. But if you kill him, he comes back, and then you have a real vampire to deal with.
I squeeze my eyes shut. She's drawing them to us, protecting Mason because even if he's been nothing but an asshole to her, that's who she is. He's defenseless. We are not.
Why the hell isn't she gagged?
Someone yells.
Because some of you know I'm right, she says. Some of you want to hear what I have to say. You want to listen to reason.
Shut that fucking bitch up!
Someone lights a match. Another lifts a lighter. Kate hooks her pinky with mine. And we wait. We grit our teeth. And we wait. One of the counselors lowers a lighter to the kindling at our feet. A cry goes up. Kate's pinky tightens on mine. But she stays perfectly still. Waiting. A piece of crumpled paper catches fire. I watch it, my heart hammering, smoke wafting to my nose, every primitive survival instinct screaming for me to break this rope. Fire. They're setting us on fire. I will myself to be calm. We are waiting on purpose, waiting for the fire to catch and the mob to relax, and then we will break free. They dare set us on fire? We will use it against them. We'll fight them off with the very weapon they sought to use against us. They light another piece of crumpled paper. As soon as they do, though, the first goes out, having never come close enough for me to feel the heat. The second piece ignites, and they light a third, right beside my sneakers, but both only burn to ash. The wood below untouched. Someone shouts in the distance. A cheer and a cry goes up as others turn. Kate gasps, and I twist to see Trisha running toward us. In her hand, she carries a familiar red canister. A gas can.
This will get the job done,
Trisha says, hoisting the can.
Oh shit, oh shit,
Kate whispers.
Now, do it now.
I flex, preparing to snap the rope, knowing it's too soon. They're not distracted, and there's no fire to use against them. Someone has grabbed the can from Trisha, and he's twisting it open as he runs, lifting it to slosh on the wood. The others ready with matches and lighters, their faces glinting, teeth bared, as predatory as a starving wolf that scents prey.
Three, Kate whispers. Two?
Hey, a voice shouts. Did I hear something about a werewolf killing party? I think you guys forgot my invitation.
I look up as Elijah walks around the building.
You're just in time, someone says. Come join the party. Don't mind if I do. I presume that other pyre is mine?
The rumble of the mob subsides as all eyes turn his way.
That other funeral pyre, he says. The empty stake? That's mine, right?
He pulls a length of steel construction rebar from behind his back and lifts it over his head.
Cause if you're burning werewolves,
he bends the rebar.
You forgot one.
Chapter 30. Kate. I hear the voice behind me. I can't see who it is. Even when I twist, but I know that voice, and my heart leaps. Then Elijah says something about not getting an invitation, and I realize he's not here to help. He's joining in, hiding what he is, in case they wonder why he didn't participate. Survival of the fittest, baby. Can't blame a guy for trying. Yes, actually, I can. And when I start to stifle my rising outrage, I stop. No, use that. Get angry.
I channel my fury at Elijah's betrayal and flex, snapping my bonds just as the crowd goes quiet, and I think, oh shit, they've noticed. They see that I'm free, and there's a moment of surprise before they'll attack. Then Elijah's voice penetrates the blood pounding in my ears.
'Cause if you're burning werewolves, you forgot one.
I twist to see him bending something metal over his head, a feat of strength that proves his claim. That's when I realize Logan's still bound.
Lo!
I say as the mob rushes for Elijah. Logan snaps the rope as I drop to claw at the one binding our feet. Someone notices. A shout goes up. Logan's already bending, his hand still misshapen with those very useful nails. Once he's working at the rope, I leave him to it. I have my fists free and I use them, slamming the first half-demon within range. Without thinking, I strike full strength, and the sickening crack of his jaw rings out, echoed by his scream of pain. I swing at the next one, hitting lighter, but not holding back the way I should. I cannot afford to truly hold back. They need to see what they're up against. As I couldn't demonstrate earlier in the melee that knocked me down before I managed more than a few clumsy blows. Now, they get the real Kate Danvers. With every blow, every scream of pain, a couple of those rushing at us falter. Something deep in their infected brains still aware enough of fear. Others, though, rush in, howling, the cries of pain and the crack of breaking bones only setting their fevers aflame. A smell hits my nostrils, acrid and sharp. Something splashes onto my jeans. Gasoline. The rope binding my legs finally falls free. I twist and kick the guy with the gas can as more sloshes onto me. He falls back. Someone throws a match. I dive out of the way just in time. I grab the gas can and swing it, contents spraying across the mob. A few cry out in agony as the gas splashes into their eyes. I empty the canister as Logan stumbles free of his foot bindings. A half-demon rushes in. Logan swings, but the guy teleports just out of reach. Another charges my brother with a penknife raised. I wheel, grab his arm, and wrench the knife from his hand. My brother keeps fighting. I don't worry about him. He has this. As I run for Mason, fog billows up around me. I slow, thinking a sorcerer is casting against me. Then I see Alan on the forest's edge, his fingers raised as he casts fog to hide me. I wave my thanks and bend behind Mason, using the penknife to cut him free. When he's loose, he rips off the duct tape gag with,
"What the hell are you doing?"
"Setting you free, asshole. You're welcome." He turns, sees me, and blinks.
"You? I thought..."
He thought it was Logan, but I don't mistake the disappointment that flashes through his eyes. He might have been giving Logan shit for coming to his rescue, but he'd been pleased, too. Seeing his mistake, he switches gears with,
"I thought you didn't like me much."
"You're an asshole, not a hanging offense, or a burning one." I take his hand and slap the penknife into it. "We'd appreciate some help."
"There are 24 supernaturals. You can't fight..."
18, but who's counting? We're not trying to take them down. We're trying to get out of here, and maybe give them a reason not to follow. Now, a half-demon charges. I hit him with a right hook that sends him yowling into the fog. I turn back to Mason and point at the knife. "Use that. Put a few holes in them. Remember, you can heal. Try not to die." I take off before he can respond. I'm racing through my fog cover when a girl stumbles in. It's Mackenzie, still wearing her Team Witch shirt. I lift my hands. "Just stay out of my way. I know you can hear me and understand me. This has gotten way out of hand, and I hope you see that. I don't want to hurt you. Well, I want to hurt you, parasite. Her lips move in a spell. I rush her, but she launches a fireball. It's a small one, barely worthy.